session number 17747, reel 42.
You were describing the bombardment of the convoy on the road, the convoy of vehicles.
Yes, that's right. That was on the 18th of September.
Was the convoy moving forward or was it moving back?
I can't remember. It may have been even moving laterally. It was moving to a new position, is all I can remember. I think back, given the context, the 167 Brigade were involved in the casualties along this road and were being pulled out of the line after very severe losses. I think it could have been their misfortune to have been shelled on the way out. But I wouldn't like to be sure exactly where people were moving. Yes, that's right. I noted in a quite separate note that I wrote at this time that the Ox and Bucks have just bled their way up the Gemano feature against terrific mortar fire and spent the night without food or water in the rain. There's no truth whatever in the diminishing opposition theory, in other words, that the Germans were giving up. It's true the Gothic line was cracked open easily, but only because it was done by surprise. And now the surprise element is gone. The German reinforcements have come rapidly, and here again we are in hard, fixed, standing, slogging battle, as the number of mortar holes in this field bears out. That was a note I wrote on the 9th of September, a week before.
So in effect, you're still working your way through a belt of defences.
That's right, yes. Mm. It was a defence in real depth, this. You couldn't get through it, because, even a day's march wouldn't have got you through it. It was still there.
And getting into it.
Right. Mm. And the more deeply embedded into it, the fiercer the thing came, and the more intractable on both sides, because the Germans didn't actually care about holding this. I noted that apropos young Rosen, who was killed on this road, the doctor comes into RHQ, having tended to Rosen at a field dressing station, and it's rather sad, worth mentioning, that as a sort of minor adjunct of war, that he said that Rosen had a great big hole, he told me, a great big hole in his back. And all he was complaining of was a pain in his lower leg.
Presumably his...
The nervous...
Nervous system,
yes,
had been damaged,
right.
So he couldn't...
Yes. That's, by the way, the Thursday, 19th of September, one of our own shells goes off prematurely 10 yards from RHQ. There must have been a nearby battery, and this was a...
You haven't mentioned that kind of thing happening before. Presumably this would have been caused by defective ammunition, or most likely caused by defective ammunition.
I don't know why I haven't mentioned it, because I thought that by this time, although it may be something still to come, I had the extra... No, it was still to come, because I moved soon from RHQ to a troop, as troop leader, and it was there that my particular troop had three guns that went out of action within a week, things exploding in the barrel, which could have been defective ammunition, it could have been defective barrels, a simple, I suppose in lay terms, metal fatigue of some kind. These guns, we've talked before about whether they were the same guns that we'd had at Salerno, and I think we've decided that logically they couldn't have been, because there was no point in touting 25-pounder guns around the world, or even around the Mediterranean, unnecessarily. And we had taken over and been relieved by different regiments in Anzio, and again we took over somebody's guns when we got back into Italy. So these must have been different guns. On the other hand, it's reasonable to suppose that given a fair apportionment of firing between the different regiments in Italy, that most of the guns would have done something approximating to the same amount of use. And I think it's also fair to conclude that some of them were getting pretty tatty by this time. However, one of our shells went off prematurely. Why? I've noted that we... Yes, of course, I noted a week ago that we'd lost the Padre. The Padre had been killed by a shell, that's right. A new young Cockney Padre arrives, a cheerful chap. A bit of shelling at headquarters. We move forward to the much-stonked village of Mulazzano, which was captured 2 days ago by the infantry, M-U-L-A-double-Z-A-N-O. We have a bit of shelling there. A new padre arrives, Bartlett by name. We settle in. I find the new CO difficult to gauge. The war is going well here, but the casualties are heavy and the fighting continues to be fierce. On duty, midnight till 2 a.m. on the phones. Some high-velocity shelling. Then a very dull day, and we're expecting a counterattack on our front. The new CO reminds me of the one we had for a short time in December to February. This is libelous, but I've put stupid and starchy. Our tactical headquarters is put on notice to move once again. Rain begins, and I end a perfectly bloody day by being washed out of bed.
Washed out of bed?
Yes, I must have been on a sleeping on the ground on a
stream bed, presumably, or something of that sort.
Sounds as though I was not on my camp bed, which I scarcely have been washed out of.
You mentioned that a counterattack was expected. Do you remember what the indications were? What the evidence was?
I would have thought at our level, the evidence would be quite simply provision of this surmise from divisional headquarters.
Yes.
You know, word has it that.
Hmm.
I can't think of any concrete evidence that one would normally accumulate that a counterattack was being planned. You don't even know when one was coming, had begun.
Did it actually occur?
I don't think it did, judging from what now follows, which is that it's very wet. We're completely cut off. The roads are impassable, so we're stuck. Ironically, there is now talk of a government scheme being drawn up for demobilisation. The blueprint for demobilisation gives me about another 2 years in the army if I survive and if the war finishes. But at least the financial side is good. I'm due to get 15 shillings and sixpence rise from the 25th of September. Obviously put up the standard rate of pay. I was getting at this time, or had been since being commissioned, roughly speaking, about £4 a week.
What did you do with that money? Did you manage to save a lot of it?
It was banked. We didn't physically receive it. Mm. I did save quite a bit of it. I squandered it. Most absurdly, as soon as the war finished and I got home as a student again, I gave vast parties and spent it all. That's the top and bottom of the matter. Instead of doing something sensible.
But, I mean, at that time, being in the field, presumably the opportunities for spending would have been rather limited.
I mean, you drew money when you wanted it. A cashier would come once a week, once a fortnight, particularly if you... and the cashier would turn up very rapidly if you were in a place like Rome or Cairo where you wanted money. You drew it. And the rest just mounted up. You needed some, of course, for paying mess bills, which were a constant throughout the war. Yes, it's very difficult to gauge this. I mean, I was not married. There was no question of any money going home to anybody else. It was just £4 a week being saved, subject to what you wanted to draw out. £4 a week was £200 a year. I was commissioned from beginning to end for about roughly 2.5 years. So £500 is the limit of what I drew in toto as a commissioned officer, plus a bit more, to be fair. Once one got an overseas allowance, Mediterranean allowance of X shillings a day. But I can't have earned as an officer in 2.5 years plus more than about £600 or £700, put it as high as that. And of that, I think I had about £300 to come home to when demobilised. There was also a war gratuity at the end, which amounted, in my case, I think, to about £55 or something. So one was technically quite well off to come home to, but of course there was nothing to buy. I mean, had I wanted to buy a flat, for example, had I been in work already and not a student again, it would have been very difficult to find one. However, this is all by the way, but it's part of the social context of all of these things. One was drawing a salary, but was not paid.
Did it occupy your thoughts at all? Your
not even remotely.
Affairs?
No, not even remotely. We had, I mean, we unmarried young subalterns. I was only still short of 23 at this time, 22.5. Money was the very last thought, because everything was provided. You weren't having to, buy food or drink minimally through mess bills. It was a time of financial total irresponsibility. There was nothing to spend money on. And money ceased to be important for that reason. It was a sort of opposite of Thatcherism, if you like. However, I noted on the 22nd of September that the division has had 3,000 casualties in 3 weeks fighting out of 15,000 men.
That's quite a heavy
toll, isn't
it? But you said at the same time the war was going well. Does this mean you were moving forward?
It meant that at great cost we were winning, in essence.
You were gaining the ground but paying a high price.
That's right.
Loss of life.
That's right. And I noted also that our 167 Brigade was the worst, had the worst casualties within that divisional loss. I've put that we have advanced in that 3 weeks about 20 miles.
Now, another thing you were saying earlier on was that implied that the enemy was still holding Germano. They had been after you'd shifted eastwards.
They were still holding it, were they?
Well, you mentioned at one point that you heard that the Rifle Brigade or the Ox and Bucks had...
Well, they just bled their way up the
Germano
feature. I didn't say whether they'd actually taken it or not.
No.
I don't know. By this time, of course, it must have gone. Of course, this was written. That was on the 9th of September.
Yes.
Now we're talking about 22nd, and I think we're well beyond Germano, which I think is quite a prominent hill village. I mean, I'm still vaguely conscious of it on the map.
But it sounds as though what had happened had been that the 56th Division had stopped attacking in the mountains and had swung round to the slightly lower ground and was pushing up the coast, which would have outflanked the Germano area.
Yes, indeed, which leaves open the question of whether somebody else had taken it or not. That's right. What I'm trying to remember as we speak is whether the Ox and Bucks were our 3rd Battalion at this time in 167 Brigade, as well as the 8th and 9th Fusiliers. I think they may very well have been. And I think that 168 or 169 Brigade was probably wholly or largely the Queen's Regiment.
Yes.
Now, nobody in the division is now in the line, and there is little doing. Read books, write home. The 1st Armoured Division, that must have been the battle, the tank battle, 1st Armoured Division, is now being disbanded, and we obviously had been supporting them. We're now supporting the 43rd Gurkha Brigade. Also, 168 Brigade is being disbanded. There is complete divisional reorganisation. And we're interested to hear on the BBC that 56th Division is mentioned as being in action again. In fact, we had just pulled out, but...
Do you think that was a genuine error, or perhaps a matter of deception?
It looks as though it's a bit of deception, doesn't it? Mm. Alternatively, of course, it could have been that what had been pulled out of the line was 167 Brigade and 168, and there could still have been a remnant or something of 56th Division in action. The whole division being pulled out, I'm not quite sure about. It seems a bit odd that the whole division should have been pulled out. On the other hand, it may have been. Sunday the 24th of September, we're on forward reconnaissance again, back to the same old grimy business. Do some perilous liaison officer work on narrow roads on a motorbike with tanks coming in the opposite direction, and the tank being rather bigger than the motorbike. I go to HQRA. We move from our rest position. We're obviously going back into action. The BBC will perhaps write they knew more than we did. Long delays on the roads. Chat with the Canadian. Whether there was a Canadian division there or a brigade, I don't know.
Could it perhaps have been a Canadian loan officer?
Well, it could have been. It could have been an individual, yes. The wretched scut car sticks in a ditch again, and I go the rest of the way hitching a lift in an ambulance. Eventually arrived at an enormous house with very thick walls. Everybody is in a bad mood. I'm on duty on 4:30 a.m. onwards. Unlocated smells in the house. Query bodies.
Tell me more about these tanks. I mean, these presumably were enemy tanks coming.
Oh, no, no, your no. Own this tanks. Was our own tanks. Yes. I was sharing a road with tanks.
Right.
I was on a motorbike, feeling slightly vulnerable.
Yes.
I think I may have misused the word, but I say perilous work on a motorbike against the tanks. I think against is probably the wrong word. I probably meant...
alongside.
In opposition to...
Yes.
Not opposition, apposition.
Do you remember what sort of tanks they were?
No, I don't. Mm. But I would guess that by this time they were probably American ones, Sherman, something like that. I don't remember seeing Churchill tanks. You know more about this than I do, where Churchill tanks, when they came and where.
Well, they were used primarily for infantry support operations normally against fortified lines, but they were rather heavy and cumbersome.
Yes. They would not have been easy things on these mountain roads, or narrow roads.
Yeah.
Forget about the mountains, yes.
Sherman was rather narrower.
Hmm. Yes. I note, incidentally, I said something about 15... shillings and sixpence rise, that was per week, because I've noted on the 25th of September that I joined the army 3 years ago today, and it's a pure coincidence that my pay goes up by 2 shillings and threepence a day from now. It wasn't because it was my birthday, I think it was the anniversary of joining up, it was pure coincidence. Read Peter Abelard. Write home and discuss the prospects for me arising from this white paper just published on demobilization. My military age group is only 40 from a demob angle. They were grouping people, putting everybody into a national demobilization group as an order of priority for demobbing in the event. Of course, it was all overtaken by Class B release for people like students and
yes,
the like.
I mean, how far down the chain of command did this information go? Did the soldiers get told?
Oh, yes. I mean, this was public knowledge. This was white paper, parliamentary stuff. It was part of the news.
And, I mean, how did the soldiers receive this?
Oh, well, I think everybody was ambivalent about it because we were in the middle of action, which we might not survive. There was no particular sign of the war finishing there. Everybody sensed that it was reaching that stage. There was optimism that somebody at least was regarding us as people who might be civilians again, which was a concept one had almost forgotten. I mean, you felt you were in uniform for good.
What about the question of service in the Far East? Did anyone anticipate that as a possibility?
It was in the back of all of our minds, I think, that the war in the Far East might not end when the European one did. And this this was a dread which went on, of course, way beyond the end of the war in Europe, as my diaries show. What I find difficult to comprehend at this point in time is why the government was publishing plans for demobilisation. It must have been very confident, much more confident than we were. It was presumably based on the rapidity of the advance in northwest Europe, which we were not sharing.
It could also be that at the end of the First World War, the government had produced an extremely elaborate plan for demobilisation based upon the requirements of the economy and employment prospects, and that this had led to mutinies. And in the Second World War, they decided that it should really be age and length of service that determined release dates.
That's right.
Because this seemed to be, to the troops, to be fairer.
Yes, than being called out because you were a
plumber or
a steel
electrician.
Worker or
exactly.
Whatever.
Yeah. Yes.
Yes. Yes.
And the government, at the end of the First World War, had been very shocked by the
reaction
of the troops. Yes. Yes.
Yes. Yes. Yes, the sure instinct of the common man is something which governments disregard at their peril.
Exactly. The other thing I want to ask about was the question of breaking up brigades and so on.
Yes.
What sort of impact this had upon your consciousness? Because it sounds fairly drastic that formations with which you've been associated were suddenly disappearing.
That's right. That's right. Indeed. And we had not, in fact, been supporting 168 Brigade, so we had a vicarious interest in this. This was somebody else's brigade. Ours was 167. And although 167 had suffered the heaviest casualties, it was not the one which was being disbanded.
I mean, did you know why this was being done?
No, no. No, we you tend to take things as they come along. I mean, when you're in this kind of ridiculous lifestyle, which war is, I mean, nothing is really a surprise, and nothing matters dramatically in terms of the kind of thing which would obsess you as an ardent follower of the news at home, becomes of no account when you're in possibly death situations. It's all irrelevant, as long as it hasn't got a direct bearing. I mean, we're far more interested in whether we were going to be sent in to action the next day and whether we were going to be facing a crack German division. These were structural things. It was interesting. If 167, to bring it close to home, if 167 were being disbanded, I think we would have been really torn and a bit shaken by this, because it would have meant severing relations with people we knew quite well, very well, particularly those of us who were at headquarters. It wouldn't have affected our batteries, because apart from the battery commander who liaised with a particular battalion commander, and apart from the troop commanders who were at observation posts with the infantry, the ordinary gunners did not meet infantry, except casually. It would be a very small percentage of men in the entire regiment of 700 who had any day-to-day dealings with the infantry, with the brigade, and to whom this would have been of more than passing interest.
Did the division get another brigade to replace?
Well, that's what I can't remember. It may be that the brigade was being replaced by ad hoc groupings of people like the Gurkhas we had just acquired, you see, and at some point we acquired a Jewish brigade. I may have mentioned this already. Brigadier Benjamin's Jewish brigade came in at some point around here. There was a lot of reorganization going on. We didn't know how far it was to do with other fronts in the war. I mean, there could have been something about to happen, for all we knew, in the Balkans, people being moved to the Western Front.
Well, it's round about this time that the army was facing an alleged crisis in manpower, particularly in regard to infantry, and they were breaking up divisions in
Northwest
Europe. 50th Division was broken up during the late autumn of 1944 to provide replacements for other formations.
Sort of cannibalisation.
Cannibalisation, yeah. And former gunners, particularly anti-aircraft gunners, there was little employment, were being transformed into infantry and sent off as replacements.
I have an old friend to whom this happened, from being guarding the south coast, 3.7 ACAT guns. He was crossing the Rhine in a canoe.
Which must have been rather a shock.
Yes, traumatic. Yes. You see here, bearing on what I said a moment ago, Tuesday the 26th September, I paid my first visit to 43rd Gurkha headquarters experienced a very close shell burst while there. They seem a very decent crowd and should be interesting to support. Roads are very bad indeed. Managed to get a spirits issue in Naffy this week, and I promptly removed my bottle from the mess before the others get it, because I didn't drink spirits and I used to give them to my gunners against all the rules.
Had you become a troop leader by this time then?
No, I hadn't, so it wouldn't be to my troop, gun troop, that I would give the spirit to. It would be to my RHQ people.
Your intelligence section?
Yes, that's right, and the surveyors. We all mugged it together. And one of the surveyors, in fact, had been a form below me at school. We were a fairly intimate crowd. There was no standing on ceremony. I mean, the enemy was the CO, not the officer, other rank thing. I don't mean that seriously, but the alignments were not of the traditional kind. It was fairly intimate and pally. We messed together in action. And
so it was a common mess, all ranks mess when we were in action.
I mean, it was mess tins, so it was a cookhouse with the mess. There was a catering corporal who, of course, was part of the RHQ staff, and he had one or two cooks under him, so we fed tolerably well, even though it was out of mess tins.
But were you able to get extra rations by local purchase?
Oh, yes. Yes, but that did need a bit of organisation and was better achieved when we were not directly in action and when we had an established RHQ mess, which one tended not to have when guns were firing, but you very much, very rapidly acquired as soon as you were pulled out of the line. It was the first thing that happened, setting up a mess. Now we come to the geography of this. We've been talking about steadily getting onto lower ground. 27th September, we moved at 1600 hours. We crossed a river onto the plains at last. Now this was the beginning of the massive Po Valley, which goes up for 100 miles.